When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, talking side-by-side shotguns with author Doug Stewart. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 212. Welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. We've got a great conversation coming up with author Doug Stewart in just a moment. Back by popular demand, we're going to do a little Q&A and talk plenty of shotguns with Doug. But first, of course, thank you to Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, all the listeners out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show, helping to keep the Birdshot Podcast coming your way for everybody. And one of the benefits for Patreon supporters is that they are eligible for monthly giveaways. I've got the February winner to announce, which is a one-year subscription to Onyx Elite, which gives you all the benefits of Onyx Hunt, access to land information in all 50 states, and a whole lot more via the Onyx Elite platform. If you weren't fortunate enough to win, like Jerome was this month, you know, sign up and use the code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. And with February in the rear view, we got to preview the March giveaway. We've got a good one this month from another partner on the show, Final Rise. I have got a camo Final Rise Summit turkey vest that I'm putting up for grabs in March for the next Patreon monthly giveaway. It is the multicam version. Everything you love about the Final Rise vest in camo, with a few slight tweaks, including a seat pad and some different pocket setups for turkey hunting. I can't wait to try my new Final Rise turkey vest in the spring woods this year. And I will just say that I suspect that not everybody that listens to the show is a turkey hunter, so this will be winner's choice if the winner of this month's Patreon giveaway is interested in the Final Rise turkey vest. It will be theirs. Otherwise, we've always got Onyx Elite subscription cards available as well. So we'll see what happens there. But anybody signed up for Patreon before the end of March will be eligible for that next giveaway, which will be for the Final Rise Summit Series turkey vest. In addition to the giveaways, Patreon supporters get access to bonus content, some exclusive discounts, and of course, we set everybody up with some Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers. You can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. All right, don't forget to leave a rating, review, subscribe, follow, like, share the podcast. Any of those little things that anybody can do out there listening just takes a moment, and they all add up. They are all helpful to the Birdshot Podcast. So thank you for anyone taking a moment to do that as well, if you haven't already. And I think that's what I got for updates. Hope y'all are doing well out there. I've been hearing from some listeners that are already getting their dogs back out in the woods, snow-free woods, I might add, which is definitely not the case where I'm at. We got a lot of snow to melt. We probably got a foot last week, but temps have been pretty mild. It's been a real pleasant winter. It's a good week to be a Minnesota hockey fan, if you are, happen to be one. It's the high school state tourney this week, aka the tourney, as we like to call it here in Minnesota. Got that in the office on all week. Things are heating up. The magic of the tourney is on full display. In fact, there is an overtime game currently in progress on in the Birdshot Podcast Studios between the Moorhead Spuds and the Edina Hornets. If you know, you know. But other than that, I am looking forward to getting back out and hopefully shooting some clays very soon with the nicer weather. And as you can tell by the Patreon giveaway this month, spring turkeys right around the corner. That's what I'm looking forward to. But today we are talking shotguns on the Birdshot Podcast. Longtime listeners will be familiar with author Doug Stewart, author of a couple of books focused on side-by-side shotguns. We've had Doug on a few times, including pretty recently, late last year. And as I say on the episode, he's back by popular demand. Heard from a number of people that had specific questions, wanted to get Doug back on, and Doug heard a bunch of the same. Talked to some folks at Pheasant Fest as well. And Doug and I had a chance to connect last week and go through some of that Q&A, which is always fun. Love getting questions from the listeners and answering those with a guest along for the ride. It was a fun conversation. And if you're into side-by-side shotguns, double guns, vintage guns, there's going to be something in here that will interest you. So I think with that said, we'll jump right into it and welcome into the conversation and back to the Birdshot Podcast once again, Doug Stewart. All right, I'm ready to go. How about you, buddy?
I'm ready.
Okay. Welcome back to the Birdshot Podcast. My friend Doug Stewart, back by popular demand, and that is literally back by popular demand. How you doing tonight, buddy?
Hey, I'm good. I mean, I couldn't ask for more, but to be talking about side-by-sides on a Friday night.
Yeah, right there with you. Friday evening, not much else to do, and we're going to be talking lots about upland bird hunting guns, and we've got a list of questions that we had Doug on recently. That was December, I believe, so not that long ago, just late last year. And we sort of kept in touch after the episode, and I know you were getting sort of pounded with questions and lots of inquiries, and I was as well. And I can say that I have heard from a number of folks that's, you got to get Doug back on. And I'm like, you know, we get him on once a year, pretty much. We've had him on the podcast, but they wanted Doug back. And even as recent as I was at Pheasant Fest a couple weeks ago in Minneapolis, and heard from multiple people there that were saying how much they enjoyed the interviews with you, Doug, and wanted to get you back on. So of course, thank you once again for joining us, and we're happy to have you back here.
And thank you for having me on, Nick, because I just appreciate you, and I appreciate all the new people entering the uplands and showing this incredible interest and side-by-side shotguns and bringing back a little tradition to our country.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have we got a list of questions that Doug sort of accumulated from people asking him, and I tagged a few on here towards the end. We'll see where we get to. But we're going to get to those momentarily. But what have you been up to? Anything? You've been out shooting shotguns, shooting clays, or doing anything? Most of the seasons are pretty much closed. You're out in Colorado, right?
Yeah, we hunted bird season pretty hard, and then now and through the end of March, once every few weeks or a month, I'll take the dogs to a bird farm just to keep them on birds and give me a good excuse to take a hammer gun out and shoot some pen-raised birds, you know.
Yeah.
And now I kind of move into this season where I start buying, selling, and trading some guns.
Okay.
Gun collecting a little more now that I'm not hunting so much, you know.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common, you know, this time of year. The days are getting longer now, but when we find ourselves in the depths of winter and the days are short and there's lots of those dark hours where we're looking on Guns International and scrolling around on our phones, trying, you know, lots of time to ponder and pontificate, I think.
It is. And so I get to enjoy them all year one way or another.
Yeah. Do you shoot a lot of clays or not really?
I do not.
Okay.
I used to, but now the time, the money, and to tell you the truth, I get to shooting my guns great just from swinging them and mounting them in my house.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big believer that sporting clays makes you a better upland bird hunter. So I don't do much of it at all.
Okay.
Instead, what me and my wife do a couple times before season is we go out and throw our own clay pigeons.
Yep.
I got a little ground one that you step on,
Yeah,
and
okay.
I have her launch them whenever and wherever she wants, and I've got to be just holding my gun with the safety on, gazing off in the distance. And that's how I get good at, sudden bursts of birds, and I make it more like hunting,
Yeah, we've talked to shooting instructors and stuff before on the show and talked about how you can sort of tailor and tweak clay shooting to upland bird hunting because out of the box, it's not necessarily always suited to that. But it is interesting. And I will say, over the past handful of years since I've been doing the show and talking to those wing shooting instructors, I have done a lot more practice gun mounting and swinging around the basement and stuff at home, and that is definitely not without some results. I think it's definitely helps consistency of gun mount and that sort of thing. And I was going to ask you, one of the people that I specifically spoke to after I had you on the last time, he wanted to get you back on, and I asked him, what would you want me to ask Doug about? And his main thing was the instinctive wing shooting side of things, that shooting at upland birds and how the shotguns and stuff align with that. So,
Okay, I.
yeah, let's jump off there and then we'll hit your list.
Okay, that's perfect. I've been upland bird hunting for 40 some years, and this is what I exclusively do, and that's why I specialize in lightweight upland bird guns. That's what both my books are about. And it is totally different than shooting clay pigeons. I can't believe how many times I go out with guys that are just rock stars out shooting clay pigeons, and they can't hit birds for anything, and they can't figure out how I can. And if you really think about it, as I'm walking, my gun is not mounted, and when a bird flushes, I have to stop walking, step forward with my foundation with my left leg, and I have to mount and shoot in a swinging fashion. And this bird comes up slow and gets fast. The exact opposite of a clay pigeon. A clay pigeon starts out fast and glides out there and gets slower, slower, slower.
Right.
And it doesn't fly like a clay pigeon, obviously. They're fluttering. And a lot of people don't realize that. And they end up shooting behind the birds. They have more of a heads-up style shooting, which is more natural with birds because you're trying to use all the peripheral vision to see what direction they're coming from. You're alerted. There's more than one bird. So I find that in fast instinctive, people seem to curl up more in a ball. They seem to try to get solid footing. They hug their gun more, and they have a little bit more heads-up style shooting. Everything they're telling you not to do with clay pigeons, and it's just natural instinct. So therefore, you find your gun needs to be balanced a little bit different. You find out you usually need more drop in the stock than the old fitter told you. You usually find out you need a little shorter stock than they told you. And I just come on to this time after time, and I talked about it in my second book. So you need to take into account it is different. I mean, I'm trying to keep my balance on the side of a hill, shooting at chuckers, and they're escaping downhill, and I'm actually twisting and shooting downhill. And that's totally anything different than I'm doing with clay pigeons. And this bird is gaining speed like a rocket going downhill. It sure as heck isn't gliding out there getting slower. So my gun does need to be, faster, and I do need to be able to mount it quickly. And it just feels so much different. And it can really screw me up if I'm in a rut just shooting clay pigeons with a much heavier gun, and or I'm standing at a post, shooting driven birds coming in. And so there's a lot of difference there. And so I don't think the same gun obviously suits both sports.
Right.
And that's what's so neat about, like we were talking about earlier, like the Upland Gun Company with the new RFMs, is they seem to be geared up more for upland bird hunting, and you can actually be, fitted for one for this purpose. Maybe a little more open choked, the style of stock you want. And so I think tonight we need to make these distinctions, these difference, because we're about the upland hunting birds. I mean, that's what you're an expert in. We're chasing the quail, we're chasing the grouse species and the pheasants and all the different partridges and woodcock and grouse. And that's a different ball game.
Yep. And it's definitely the of interest to the folks that would be turning into the Birdshot podcast. So that's what we are here to talk about. So yeah. Good stuff on instinctive. You know, we have and could do whole episodes on instinctive wing shooting, but I think that was a good premise of sort of the things you're thinking about at a high level when it comes to guns and instinctive wing shooting. And just like you say, I think most people would be familiar with it, but that said, I have talked to people even within the last week or two that have been hunting with guns that would fall. I would categorize them much more on the side of a Clay's gun, a big, heavy gun that they are sort of at this point in their hunting and shooting career, they're just sort of using one gun to do everything, which, you know, we all start somewhere. But as you do this stuff more, I think people, that's when you start to sort of think about specializing and maybe adding another tool to the, or another golf club to the golf bag, that sort of thing. You know, we can have different guns to do different things.
And I agree. And I understand they want the heavy guns and they're shooting over 100 rounds and that dampens the recoil.
Yep.
But they're not carrying them like we are for, you know, walking 10, 12 miles in a day and in rugged terrain. They're not doing that at all in a sporting clay course.
And you could very, very simply sort of distill it down and just say, you know, a Clay's gun, you are carrying a little, putting it in the rack, waiting to shoot, and then you're picking it up and you're shooting a lot with it. And you could say the upland gun is the complete opposite. You carry it a lot and you shoot it very little. And those, you know, that's oversimplifying it, but those sort of parameters really, I think, really highlight how the gun is going to look and feel different just by laying that out.
Absolutely. And I want a gun that I don't even have to think about. I just jump into motion and I'm like, how did I just hit that bird? I don't even remember mounting it.
Yeah. All right, let's kick off the list. And one of them, you sort of highlighted that, and I'm curious because I don't even know if you've had a chance to see one, but obviously people, they listen to the show and they're asking Doug, the third party, what do you think of RFM shotguns? Have you had a chance to see one in person, Doug?
Well, I've seen them. I don't own one and haven't ordered one yet because I'm kind of past that in my life. I ordered and had some guns made for me, as you well know.
Sure.
And now I know what fits me, what I like. And now that I'm an older guy, I really like vintage guns that are old. But the RMF, I think, is what's neat about it from everything, the feedback I've gotten, is that they're very affordable and reliable. And they're geared up more for these upland bird hunters, which is what we're about. And they can actually get one made to fit for these guys that want to do it.
Yep.
And I had to do it. And this is the most affordable way to do it. I mean, when I had my foxes, people can't, a lot of people go afford to have a Connecticut fox made for them.
Right.
And I also had an Arietta made for me, and shoot, the RFMs are even cheaper than those. So it's a great option for a guy that's like, I can't go buy these old vintage guns. I'm 6'5" and I need a 15-inch stock, and I'm not just an average build, and I know exactly what I want, and I just can't find it. Well, there you go. You can build your dream gun, and you can make your own memories with it, and there's nothing wrong with that. So it's a good route to go, and everybody should at least try that once. They really should.
Yeah. It'll be 2 years in May that I've been sort of working for Upland Gun Company and dealing with RFM shotguns. So it's been really fun for me. I've talked to tons of customers that listen to the show, and it's specifically on the side-by-side of things. You know, they do make over-unders as well, which that market is much more saturated. There's lots more options. But as far as new side-by-sides go, offerings tend to be pretty limited. And again, that's what we found from our customers, is just the ability to sort of dial in, tweak things the way you want with respect to grip and finishings and aesthetics, and then add on to that stock dimensions, getting the fit right. That's where it starts to make a lot of sense for folks. And you did touch on sort of new gun versus vintage gun? And there's another question later in the list, which I think that's a great question. So we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to number 10, it looks like. But okay. All right. So we've maybe even premised some of this stuff, but number two, we're just going in the order that Doug and I threw these together on. So number two is, what makes a great upland gun?
Okay. So when you're looking for a great upland gun, we already touched on it, like you said, a little bit, is you got to have a gun that you can comfortably carry. And, you know, me being a side-by-side guy, I think an upland gun, it'd be great to have two different chokes instantly. And I think the gun, you know, needs to be fast and comfortable and something that you really enjoy to shoot and enjoy even looking at.
Sure.
I love, mine are like furniture in the house. I love looking at them. I love taking pictures out of them with the birds. And I really believe that, you know, a proper side-by-side is the best upland bird gun ever made, and it always will be. I mean, it puts your hands in the same plane as your eyes. They can be built with much better balance, so you're going to shoot a lot more consistent and comfortably. Like I said, you got a choke selection instantly.
When you say instant choke selection, you're kind of specifically referring to double triggers, is that correct?
I am, but at the same time, even if you got a non-selective single trigger, even if you got one that doesn't, more often than not, you're going to shoot your open choke first, and when you pull the second trigger, it's your other barrel, and it's tighter, which 9 times out of 10, that's what you want.
Right.
And so, you're not going to get that with a single barrel gun.
I got you. Yeah. So I'm just lost in the double gun world. You're actually drawing comparisons to single barrel guns, which people shoot a lot of those, but that's just my head is in the clouds, Doug.
No, that's all right. I just think it's, you know, fabulous for that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're super reliable. So for every reason you can think about, that's what they're king of, and that's what they originally were made for. And that's where they really shine, is on upland bird hunting. And I think that people need to get something that they can lug around all day and that they can shoot properly. I really do. And that kind of almost, if you're on point with me, is a very big point that I can help people really figure out, was the number three question.
Yeah.
How light do I want my upland gun? And people think there's a magic formula. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that I like mine around 6 pounds, but I'm 5'8", maybe a little shorter now that I'm older. I weighed 177 pounds yesterday, and I don't have that long of arms. I'm just a smaller framed guy. So this is all relative. And people keep asking me, well, how light? And they seem to be pushing that balance.
Right. They want to, well, or they want a number, you know, everybody wants a number on a scale, which what you're saying, it's more of a formula. It's relative.
It's a formula. And I'm going to explain it to you. If everybody just can soak this in, I'm going to explain it better and more thorough than anybody has ever heard it. Okay. Like when you're 8 years old, a little Daisy BB gun feels about right with its 12-inch stock. It's light as a feather. Man, they can handle it good. If we pick it up, boy, it's a toy. We can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a friend that's, you know, 6'4½", well over 300 pounds. I mean, long arms. I mean, he's a Sasquatch, okay? And a 7-pound gun for him is pretty light.
Yeah.
And pretty manageable, okay? So how you can really tell is you should be able to just point your gun time after time and hit a spot and it's steady. You should be able to swing it like I do in the house where the ceiling meets the wall. There's a seam, and I can just zip it down the seam left to right. And my gun's steady, and it's smooth, because birds fly straight lines. If I get a gun too light, I can't. It bobbles up and down, and I can't swing it smoothly down that line.
Mm.
I can't point it with any steadiness time after time to a spot. So then that gun's getting a little bit too light for me. And people shouldn't even really get caught up in the number, because that also leads us to, we've talked about before, is a balance point.
Yeah.
Okay. The maximum balance point I ever go to is 4¼ inches past the front trigger. Okay. Now, if the gun's heavier, I go close to the front trigger to add speed to the gun. but yet the gun has enough weight to still keep it steady. Because see, if you hold a weight extended out in your hand, like 5, 10 pound dumbbell, you can't hold it very long and your shoulder's on fire, it's extended from your core. But boy, if I hold that weight right up next to my body, I can hold it all day and it feels like nothing because it's close to my core. And I got a great example of that. I just, a little while back, I bought a Parker 16 gauge and I pointed this thing around because it was a bigger one on a number one frame, 26 inch barrels. And I was like, this has got to weigh 6 1/4 pounds. This thing is fast. It feels light. And I got home and weighed it. It was 6 pounds, 10 ounces. And I took it on a pheasant hunting trip this year in quail, and I couldn't believe how comfortable this gun was to carry. And it just felt good. So I took a measurement, and from the front trigger out, it's at 3 1/2 inches, the balance point.
Wow.
And so it's crazy fast. It feels lighter than it is. But the gun's not whippy because it weighs 6 pounds, 10 ounces. And the weight's right up there against my body when I'm carrying it. Now, you get that weight extended way out in the barrels, your arms start aching carrying it, the gun's slow, and it actually is carrying much heavier than it is on the scale. So now, if this was my 6 pound gun, I like them to measure out there, you know, 4 inches. And it balances perfect. I can swing it great. It's fast, but still steady. So it's relative. The balance point is relative to the weight of the gun, and the weight needs to be to where you can carry it comfortably, but yet you can swing it smooth and point with it with great pointability.
Yeah.
So that's going to fluctuate, okay? And you can use common sense, and you can lay one right across your table. And if you got a 15-inch stock, you don't want a 25-inch barrel. That gun's not symmetrical amongst itself. Doesn't even look right.
Yeah.
So the chances of it being balanced good is not good. So you do want a relativity between your stock length and your barrel length.
Yep.
And the whole gun symmetrical. And that's what I was explaining to my big friend. And so I did, you know, I do think it varies on a person's stature. So you got to use some common sense and you got to mount these guns and feel these guns. And I'm sure that makes sense to you with all the guns you've handled now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that it is, that has increased as I've gotten to handle more and more of these guns. I think that's a huge takeaway is the number on the scale, the overall
Doesn't
weight
matter.
Of the gun does not tell the story of how a gun feels in your hands. And it's remarkable in some cases. And I've got examples very similar to the one you describe where you're expecting, you know, you pick up a gun, you feel it, you assess it, you guess where you think it's going to be and you put it on the scale and you can't believe what it actually weighs because that balance point plays into it significantly. So what I would tell people, because I hear this a lot from, you know, people, we look for the number on the scale because it's actually specific. You can put it on a scale and you can measure it. So it's a consistent point that people understand and they want to ask about that. So everybody asks about weight, but you've got to know that it doesn't always tell the whole story and you don't want to get too tied to a specific number because it will vary from gun to gun.
It will vary. And I mean, you could probably say if you want to pull a spectrum from a smaller man to a larger man for an upland bird gun, you'd probably be somewhere between 6 6 3/4 pounds. Somewhere in there would be a pretty wise, fair guesstimate for most people. And then I tell people that, you know, they're all, that's the latest craze with these sporting clay shooters is you want a barrel heavy gun. Well, that's all relative too.
Yeah.
Because I just explained how this gun here is not barrel heavy at all, but yet it swings and follows through pretty darn good because it's 6 pounds, 10 ounces.
How many inches were those? Was that 28 inch barrels on those?
It's 26.
26. Okay. Interesting. Yep. Yeah.
It's a straight gripped Parker. And that's one of the things that I like personally when I praise American guns aren't the best at it, but when I do praise American guns about Parkers is, they're pretty good balanced guns in general.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
And that's a pretty important thing to a wing shooter. And I've handled so many hundreds of guns that unfortunately I know the difference. I can pick it up and feel it, and it's, to me, it's a big deal.
Regarding the proportion side of things, when you talk about stock and barrel length, this is something I've hit it, and I know I read it somewhere. I don't, maybe it was in your book, you can tell me, but I felt like it was like something maybe the English used to say was you roughly double the length of pull to get your appropriate barrel length. Do you have any thoughts on that, or what, do you have a rule of thumb?
That used to be an old thing, you know, like if your stock is about 14 and a quarter, you want to double it for your barrels, you know, you're going to want your barrels about 28.
Right.
And that's kind of was a pretty standard thing for the English. I think we've seen the barrels shortened down since then because, you know, the improved loads that they're like, okay, we don't need to push the long barrels like we used to.
Right. Yeah.
And once again, it's going to be a little bit different because of your balance point. That you can change and is different depending on how much weight's in the framing. That's why I got to laugh when I see these new guns coming out that have these special alloy frames, and they brag that this 12 gauge only weighs 6 pounds, it's over and under because of the light titanium frame. I'm like, are you kidding me? That's where you want all the weight. That's where you want half of your weight is right in the frame. You don't want to go and make your frame feather light and have the weight in the other extremities of the gun. It's just going to feel horrible and be a slug. So, you know, once again, the weight's not the answer, and that's proof of it in the pudding right there, you know.
I've never really hunted with an alloy frame gun. I've handled a fair bit of them, and RFM does make one, so I've had the chance to see a few up close, and it's a different feeling gun. It's just the weight. Again, because the weight is not right there where you're used to feeling it on a lot of other guns, it does change the feel of the gun quite a bit. And I mean, I think a lot of people have alloy frame guns and they know what that is and are comfortable with it, but it is definitely a different feel than a traditional steel frame gun.
Oh yeah. And if you're gonna walk a long ways, like I said, I'm a personal trainer for a living. I know all about the mechanics of weights. You want it close to your body, close to your core. It's easier to carry. It's less fatiguing. It's less noticeable. And that's a given. You know, it just is.
All right. One other thing I will add for how light should my gun be. I mentioned reference Dale Whitman all the time. He's a gun fitter that we work with a lot at Up the Gun Company. And obviously I've interviewed him on the show a bunch. And I always appreciate the way he gets the idea that, you know, we're not calling out specific numbers. It's everything's relative to a certain extent, and it varies from shooter to shooter. But the way he approaches weight of a gun is, and it's very similar to what you're saying, Doug, you want as light of a gun as you can, you can shoot well, carry and shoot well. So you have a light gun, so you can carry it long distances and shoot it a little bit, but there's a line there where if you get too light, and like you're saying, Doug, and you start swinging on the lines on your ceiling and it's bobbling all over the place and you can't smoothly swing it and point it, you're probably flirting with a gun that might be too light for you.
Yep, too light. And it's so a person can figure that out if they handle some guns and they got a reference point. You know, I've given it kind of in my books, depending on your stature, where you can start.
Yep.
And we all know the lighter the gun is, you move that balance point out a little more on the barrels and it'll smooth it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. But that's all got a point of no return, you know, once you've gone too far.
Yep. All right. Next question. What gauges are best for upland bird hunting? That could be a huge topic, but
oh boy, I get this a lot.
I know, and here's why. I will just, before you jump in here, I will say gauge is just this natural thing because it's such a decision point in the, normally when you're buying a gun, you kind of, I feel like it's sort of the first thing people decide on. It's like, well, I want a 20 gauge or I want a 16. And so because it's sort of at the front end of the decision making process, it's, people think about it a lot, but gauge has become less and less relevant the more I've learned about sort of payloads and shot sizes and patterning and all that sort of stuff.
I agree. And you can put, you know, light loads in your 12 gauge, and we got such good ammunition. You can load the small bores up a little heavier than you used to be able to. And the big thing is I think that why people ask about it is, like, one, I get a lot about, 16 gauges. And I'll flat out tell you that they were the queen of the uplands, and I think they were produced for the uplands in America because almost all American 12 gauges, when I'm talking about old side-by-sides, of course, are almost too heavy to carry in the uplands comfortably for day after day after day hunting. And I am talking, when you start talking Foxes and Parkers and LC Smiths and Model 21s, 12 gauges are heavy.
They're like all over 7 pounds for the most part.
All of them. And there's a few exceptions. I mean, I've got a Parker in there that's 6¾ pounds, 12 gauge, but that's still not a lightweight. But that's when Americans start pumping out 16 gauges, and they were the queen of the uplands. Let's think about it. You got a 16 gauge Fox on a 20 gauge frame. If you got number 4 weight barrels, which was their lightweight barrels, was made for the uplands. And they're light. Lighter than most 20 gauges. They're lighter by far than any 12 gauge. So it was at home in the uplands. You got the zero frame Parkers built on a 20 gauge frame. So it meant to be a lightweight 16. It wasn't meant for goose hunting. It was meant for the uplands. The double X frame Lefevre, same thing, a 16 gauge on a 20 gauge frame. It was made for the uplands. I found some lightweight 16 gauge, LC Smiths. Mine weighs 6 pounds. So that's where the 16 gauge craze kind of came in, is they were specifically in America more for the uplands than they were duck and goose hunting, than they were for really anything else. And of course, they got pushed out when they stopped having events for them, in the trap range and shooting skeet. And then when they brought in, bigger, heavier loads for the 20 gauge. But yet the 20 gauge was still used in skeet events and sportings, trap shooting and stuff all over the country. So then you started getting a dominance of a 20 gauge. Now, it's not true in England. And in England, they're like, we didn't have to spread 16 gauges all over. We got lightweight 12 bores. And they built upland 12 bores that were crazy light, 2.5 inch, even 2 inch.
Yeah, and those were
And,
sub 6 pound guns, basically.
oh yeah. And they would really strike the barrels down. I mean, they would taper immediately after the chambers. That's why you can't lengthen the chambers in some of them. Not enough meat in the barrels, They had slender forearms. I got a 12 gauge in there that's on a 16 gauge frame. It's a nice little English gun. And you'd swear carrying that thing, you're carrying a 20 gauge. The frame's all, it's all rounded on the top. It's really thin through the wrist. So, yeah, the English made guns for driven bird shooting, which we don't want here. Because they got straighter stocks, tighter chokes, longer barrels, everything else. And then they also made up land guns over there. They did plenty of walk-up hunting there,
Rough shooting, as they would call it, right?
as they would call it. And they're lighter 12 gauges. And so that's kind of an American thing, the queen of the uplands being the 16 gauge. Now, of course, a 16 gauge, it's like magic, 1 ounce of shot in a 16 gauge. And we call it a square load. None of them are perfectly mathematically square. That's not the point. The point is they pattern great in the gun. And same thing with a 28 gauge, 3/4 ounce load. It patterns great in them. It's not mathematically perfect, but they call it a square load, which you want to think of more of a proven perfection load for that bore. But is a 1 ounce load better in a 16 gauge than a 12? No. It's fantastic. You can't really improve upon it, okay? So you'll never know the difference between shooting it through a 12 gauge or a 16. Except for when you step up to a 12 gauge, it patterns a little better with larger shot. Like if you're wanting to step into fours and fives, okay? Same thing with a 20 gauge. For the most part, 1 ounce of shot in 20 gauge, you're not going to notice too much difference.
Real world difference is pretty
Real
slim.
world difference. Nope. Except for it's going to have a little more recoil if the gun's light. And then once again, if you think you got to go up to number fives, that 16 gauge is going to shine. Okay. And then you might say, well, what if we need a premium on shot string? Well, that situation's probably only going to happen, like maybe with woodcock and grouse, or a crazy fast crossing shot on a very small bird.
Yeah, at distance
So,
and stuff. Yeah.
yeah, so the difference is not really uncanny. So you can get a great upland gun in America, probably with the 16 gauge, probably with the 20 gauge. If it's real close range shooting, like a woodcock, grouse, bobwhite, quail, you're not going to notice a difference with a 28. You'll think it's great. You only gain about 5 yards when you step up to a 20 gauge. So it depends on what you're hunting. But I would say 16 gauge on down to the 28 is real popular in America for upland birds.
Yeah.
And we're talking a dude that's going to do it all, that's going to do the quail, the woodcock, grouse, and everything. If you're nothing but a pheasant hunter, you're going to probably try to seek out this little lighter weight 12 gauge, if that's all you do. That's a whole different ball of wax with English guns. Like I said, you can carry around a 12 bore and have it be at light as can be and fast as can be, and 2.5 inch loads that don't recoil that much if they've only got an ounce of shot in them. So I hope I kind of answered it, because there's nothing wrong with the guy that wants to carry a 20 gauge.
Right.
He's only going to compromise maybe 5 to 10 yards at the most behind the 16 gauge guy. But you could argue a 16 gauge is a little more versatile, because you can bounce it up to 1/8 that shot
Right, you could always increase.
to field key number fives, and it's deadly on pheasants. And the shot string don't matter, because a pheasant's big and it's slow, and number fives don't deform as bad. It's more of an issue when you're shooting 8 shot at a fast bird, little bird. So that's where you get a little more versatility with that 16 bore. But the main thing is 20 gauge is just fine. If it fits you great, if it's lightweight, and it needs to feel good in your hands.
Yes, yep.
And I like the small grip in my hands, because I'd rather wrap my hands around something. I've got more comfort carrying it. I've got more control. And when I get these 12 gauges and I'm walking around the upland, some of them, I feel like I'm carrying a railroad tie. And it's not comfortable in my hand. It's not comfortable in my left extended hand. The whole gun's larger. The shotgun shells in my pocket are larger. And that's what makes a difference to the upland bird hunter. And that's a handling characteristic too, is how large and how, sleek and comfortable the gun fits in your armpit and everything else,
Yeah, and we've all got different body types and hand sizes and everything. And yeah, I think that's a great summarization. And I'm sort of heavily influenced by sort of what I do on a daily basis with Upland Gun Company and RFM, and the fact that we can kind of pick and choose from the menu and build different things. But I sort of come around to the thought process of, like, gauge is not the first thing that I think about. It's more
No.
weight and hand feel and characteristics, just knowing that you can pretty much alter payloads and shot sizes within some constraints to do what we needed to do as upland bird hunters. So you focus more on the individual gun, what a specific model of shotgun, what does that feel like in your hands in a 20 gauge versus a 16 or a 12, and which one feels the best to you? And then this is all sort of a, prioritization hierarchy thing, but you just have to kind of analyze that through your own, like, what you plan to do with it, the birds you plan to hunt with, the shot and the ammunition that you plan to shoot. All that's going to factor in, but it doesn't have to be a fork in the road at talking about gauge, I don't think.
It really doesn't. And if you really want to get specific, you can say, if I want to use larger shot, and all I want to do is, hunt prairie grouse and sage grouse and pheasants, I might go with the larger bore because I want to shoot more 5 shot. But if you're a guy that's, six, 7.5s, and eights, and shooting all the variety of quail and other upland bird guns, it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't. And they're not. People keep wanting to stretch the distance of everything, and they're not meant to be long range guns.
Right.
That's why we got our bird dogs, and why we try to, get as close as we can to where we get clean kills. We get to see the action. We're respecting the game. If it wants to flush at 50 yards and take off, let it be free. I mean, that bird did a great job
Right.
escaping. Pass on its genetics,
Yeah, know your limitations.
Yeah, and then you never have a problem.
Cool. All right. Well, that probably won't be the last time we talk about Gage tonight, but
probably not.
But let's. This is an interesting one, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. But how or if and how can I get an idea of gun fit without going to a gun fitter?
Yeah, I get that a lot because a lot of guys don't want to go travel. They don't have the money.
And unfortunately, good gun fitters are not, there isn't one on every street corner. I mean, they're few and far between. So it is a big hurdle for some folks. So I totally understand the question.
It's a big hurdle and it's fair. And I didn't have the luxury of that until I got older.
Yep.
And had more money and my own driver's license and could drive. But I talked about it in my books. My first book, I gave a very basic thing of how, you know, long your stock probably is according to your height. And that's very rough.
Yeah.
Because people have different arm lengths and different structure to their shoulders and build, of course. But that's a start. But when you handle a lot of guns in your home and handle them, you can see which one you can mount and do it up properly. Like I said in my book, know you're mounting it properly. And is that stock too short to where you have to, you know, lean forward, there's a gap between your shoulder, and it's just, you know, it's too short? Or is it so long that it's, you put one or two shirts on and it's hanging up in your armpit and you can't get it to hit your cheekbone? So I've got a couple different stock lengths and I can shoot them almost all depending on the width of my clothes and extending my left hand forward the length of that stock a little bit, not drastically. And then you'll notice with the pistol grip, you hug the gun a little more so the stock can be slightly shorter than a straight grip stock. And then you mount it. And you mount it properly. You bring it to your eyes and your cheekbone, like I talked about in my book. And you look at your target. Well, is the entire rib in your line of vision? Or does it start about halfway down? If it starts about halfway down, you might not have enough drop in your stock. Or the opposite, if you mount it and you're looking at the back of the receiver, you're like, man, this thing's got way too much. Drop it.
I got a gun like that here that all I can see is the back of the action.
Correct. And then you know. So you can use some judgment there. I talked about in my book, I've got a real narrow face and my eyes are set close together. I don't need much cast off. But if you got a bigger face and wide set eyes and broader shoulders, you might need more cast off. And once again, you can tell by mounting the gun properly, and is your eye staring right at the object, and is that bead sight right on that object, or is it just slightly off to the side? So once again, it's going to take trial and error with mounting different guns, maybe putting a slip-on pad on a gun to see how it feels different if you got a few guns at the house. And then once you think you got a close recipe, then you can mount it quickly and shoot it at a target and see where you're hitting that target.
Yeah.
And that's what I used to have to do when I was a kid, and because we didn't have all the luxury of this. And then next thing you know, you get to where you're like, man, I took this thing out. It felt great. I didn't even have to think about it. I can just smoke clays. I know this is close to my fit. And I explained it in my book about cast off and drop at the heel and the comb and the pitch of the stock. I explained that all in my first book. And I go way more into instinctive shooting, of course, in my second book. But that's how you do it. And you got to use patience and common sense because these guns are pointers. You're pointing them. You're not aiming them. And that's about really all you can do
on your own.
A fitter on your own. And then, of course, I measure them, you know, the old school way. I lay it on the rib on a table, and I can take out my tape and see how much drop it's got at the comb and the heel. And I can look down the rib and see if I've got X amount of cast off and get some rough measurements and kind of just keep tweaking it and going from there. I mean, they make little risers that you can put on top of your pad that you can do a layer or two thick if you're wanting not so much drop. But you got to remember, like I said, a lot of these fitters, I've been to a couple of fitters, and they always try to get you a stock that's too long and a really straight stock. And part of the reason why is they're trying to teach you good form. They want you to reach out. They want you to have your elbow up to make sure that gun's getting mounted properly up into your cheek, which is making you keep your head down because you don't want to shoot over the top of the bird. And then they pretty much push the issue that the birds are rising. And where I've ran into a problem with that in the uplands is, like I said, I can't mount the gun that perfectly when I'm in a hurried situation and when I'm not just standing there. So my body automatically just wants to grip the gun. It's almost like an instant tightening up thing, a response to a quick motion. And therefore, I never have needed a stock quite as long as they tell me. And the birds aren't rising as much as you think, because most people are so slow that bird picks up. And by the time they shoot, it's usually starting to level off and it's going where it's going. So you don't need it to shoot as high as, like, if you're bringing in guns from England. A lot of our shooting a 70-30 pattern, okay? And we don't want that in the uplands. We shoot a lot of crossing shots at our quail and out there at our prairie birds. And like I talked about, chucker, and you'll shoot right over the top of them. So make sure from England you're buying one of their guns that are for the rough shooting, because they'll have a 60-40 pattern or something. They'll have a little shorter stock usually. Usually they're lighter and balanced, more like we've been talking about, because they're made for that. And I even think that's why some of the lighter American guns I'm talking about have the dimensions they used to. And partially because men were littler back then, too. I mean, our average height has gone up.
Yeah. Gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and friend of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com. Would you say that you've hunted a lot more variety of upland birds than I have? And I'm primarily a grouse and woodcock hunter. I would you say that of all the, maybe not of all, but generally speaking, you know, the one upland hunting, grouse and woodcock hunting, is one that I think oftentimes we are shooting at rising birds. I mean, I agree with you that when you get out, and even in grouse and woodcock hunting, but you get out on the prairie, a lot of the shots you're taking aren't necessarily at a bird that is climbing to the sky. You know, they've gotten to where they don't need to get up that high to get over the cover, and they basically have leveled off, and you're shooting a crosser or maybe a little bit of rise, but they're not just climbing straight for the sky, other than sometimes in the grouse woods, the cover dictates that. So we do get some rising presentations there, but that's a good point.
It's a good point, and you're seeing that more with the woodcock and grouse, like you said, okay? But they don't really rise that fast to lose your marbles.
Right.
And if you got a gun, they're wanting you to float birds, okay, with this real high stock, because they want you to float them to where you see the target, and you're not trying to lift your head off the stock. Well, in the uplands, you're not shooting a little round disc time after time again, okay, and you don't want to float the bird as much because your eyes are wide open and you're seeing the trees and you're seeing other birds and you're trying to use your peripheral vision. Okay, so you're more likely to want to cover the bird up and get a visual. So that's why people accidentally lift their head up and at least pop their eyes up in the air more than they do when they're shooting at clay pigeons with these fitters. And I've seen that happen my entire life. And they're just like, man, you're right. I think you're right. No matter how hard I try to keep my head glued to that gun and float the bird, I end up lifting my head a little bit. And so I think people need to take that in consideration just a little bit more, and they'll be happy.
Yeah. All right. Next one, this one you maybe have a little more context. We've maybe talked about this a bit, but the question was, how is shooting different on upland birds? And I don't know if that's different versus driven or clays, or I'm not specifically sure what different is applying to, but maybe you know.
Well, I'm not sure. They could have been like what we've talked about so far. Of course, is just, you know, like driven birds. You're shooting in tons of incomers, of course. So usually the pattern of the gun's a little higher. Usually your stock's straighter and you're wanting that little bit of a belt-in lead. Mm. And the same thing with the clay pigeon stuff. Usually you're floating the targets. And upland birds, you need to have a visual on your surroundings and birds. And sometimes you're seeing the whole covey when your quail are getting up, your huns. And that's an instinct for you to see the whole covey in which direction they're going. The difference is, of course, like we've discussed, the guns need to be faster and lighter, probably more open choked, and they can't have these tall ribs and super heavy weights that you're using on the sporting clays courts in general.
Okay.
So that's pretty much the nutshell, you know, on that question from what we answered before.
Yep. All right, next one. Where do I get ammo? This is a question that's gotten a bit more interesting in the last couple of years, I would say.
Oh, yeah, it has. Well, I've noticed lately it's breaking free. And
yes.
I'm seeing a bunch of Remingtons and Federals are flooding out everywhere, and they'll be caught up no problem. It's the vintage ammo.
Yeah.
The 2.5-inch low pressure stuff has been a little bit more of an issue. And that's because these low pressure powders, we're having a hard time getting them in because certain companies like, you know, RST and stuff was pulling them in from Italy. And of course they closed all those factories down during the COVID stuff.
Yep.
And then everybody hoarded it and they called RST and bought cases and cases and cleaned their factory out. So it's a combination of people bought way too much and hoarded it, and the supply wasn't there. Well, then when the supply started dribbling in, I'm sure the factories are way behind. They're short-staffed employees, which seems to be an issue everywhere after the COVID. And then people are still hoarding it when they can get it. But I just talked to Chris at RST. Morris Baker wasn't available. Mm. He's a great guy. And she assures me, hey, they're going to continue to sell it. It's going to start ramping up. Mm. They keep dribbling it out a little bit here and there.
Yep.
Limit of 5 boxes a person at a time or something. And just to be patient, they're trying to get some agreements with some different people, like maybe Remington or something with some low-pressure powder. But that's just not their priority right now because they got so behind on all the other ammunition.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's kind of a small deal,
right?
Producing this low pressure stuff. It's a niche.
Very much so. Yeah,
it's going to start happening, and then some of these guys that hoarded it, they're going to start selling some out of their cases, and it'll be all right.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good report from RSD. I've been checking their website a little bit recently. It's a bummer that they have not been able to keep their supply up because they were a provider of such specialized stuff. You know, I mean, low pressure being one of it, but they're great about payload, you know, having a variety of payloads and shot sizes. I mean, they were sort of the go-to for, you could really dial in what you wanted from a factory ammunition standpoint that you couldn't do with lots of other brands.
And what I do is, if, you know, since I'm kind of dealing with vintage guns, if somebody buys a gun from me, I sell them, you know, 3 or 4 boxes
to get them started,
to get them rolling with their gun. 'Cause I got quite a stockpile.
Are you one of those hoarders, Doug?
Well, I guess I am. I've got to.
You've been a long-term accumulator, right?
Oh man, and I was calling the kettle black there when I come to think about it. To tell you the truth, holy cow! And so I had a question right about that one too. About, I just keep getting nailed with what affordable guns are good, you know.
Mm.
And they, people are finding out, because they're wanting to get into these side-by-sides, is that they're not cheap, okay?
Right, right. Yeah, especially, you know, affordable is a relative word. That varies for everybody, but it also varies by the kind of gun you're looking at, and just the cost that it takes to produce a side-by-side versus some other guns is, it's a different relative scale.
And I try to explain to them, because they'll see an 870 at Walmart or something, and they're wanting to get side by sides, and they're like, holy cow, this is a whole different deal.
How do we go from
Well,
500 bucks
and
to 5,000 bucks in a hurry, you know?
I tell them that, all these hobbies people have a passion for, I don't care if they're golf and if they're into four wheeling.
Fishing.
I've got friends that they spend a lot of money in their hobbies. Okay.
Yep.
This is the same kind of thing. And of course, the side by sides, you're buying two barrels instead of one. They've got to be regulated to hit to the point of aim. You got a more complex trigger system. I mean, so they're more expensive guns, but I tell people that there is some good, affordable guns out there. And it has amazed me how affordable you can get, like, a little English box lock from Vintage Doubles. I mean, you can get a pretty awesome one for $2,500 that balances and is incredible. And I'd rather have one of those myself than a Spanish gun any day. Okay. And I'm not really ripping on them because I talked about how great my AYA number two was in my second book. So they do exist, but it was an older one. Okay. And I've had some good ones. But in general, the English guns really know how to balance their guns, and they have a better balance and feel to them. And they seem to be regulated better. Every time I've ever tested them, they shoot to the point of aim and have great patterns, and I don't even have to worry about it, but I have had to worry about it with Spanish guns. They just don't seem to be balanced as well, and they have a little more of an issue regulating them for some reason. So I'm thinking, hey, if you can get an English box lock that's just a dynamite up land gun for $2,500, great. And if you don't want something vintage, we talked about the RFMs. We've talked about CZs before. We've talked about Dickinsons before. I mean, there is some out there that might be a great gun for somebody to start with.
And I think I mean, I think it's fairly maybe sort of baked in or obvious to folks, but when you're talking the vintage gun side of things, an English box lock, that $2,500 box lock, it's part of the reason it's $2,500 is because it might be 100 years old and it still functions and handles and works beautifully, which is just that's just a cool part about vintage guns. But if you were going to turn around and make that same gun new with that same probably hand engraving, I mean, who knows what the cost of that? It would be a lot more than $2,500 if that thing was brand new coming off the line.
Oh, if it was brand new, they'd be selling it minimally, $25,000. And of course, you could pay another $1,000 to $1,500 for a comparable side lock, that's vintage. But I want to tell everybody and explain to everybody. A lot of people got caught up in they were, emailing me and, oh, I look at these Purdy's and these Hollands and Grants and Woodwards, and they're filthy expensive. I mean, they can't usually find a pretty less than $25,000, an old one. And I said, that's the beauty of these English guns, is you can get a little no-namer that's just as good. I got an Arthur Hill and Son in there, and I pulled the locks out of that thing. Kirby told me it was a great gun. I had to do it, okay? I pulled the locks out of them. It was made in the 1930s, and it looked like it was made yesterday. Wasn't a single file mark on them. Polished smooth. The inletting was incredible. It snapped in and out of my gun like a Rolex watch. And I've had a Purdy before. I own a Boss still, but and my Purdy I don't think was quite that good in the locks. Because of course I had to take it apart. But and this is an Arthur Hill and Son. You're like, well, who is that? Well, if you research it, they probably worked for one of these big makers, getting paid hourly. They decided to freelance on their own in their little shop at home with their sons and put out some of their own guns. And they got a good relationship. They can get the barrel blanks and stuff, no problem. And they're just like, hey, we don't have to make that many guns. We just got to make them great. And we'll make more money than we were. We'll be able to retire in a decade or less. So then you can get all these neat, high quality English guns without thinking that you have to have a brand name. And you do, you meet people that, they look like they walked out of an Orvis catalog and they want to shoot a Purdy, this and that. That's fine. If they can afford to do it, more power to them. But if you can't, there's stuff out there just as good that comes from a little ma and pa shop, and that actually means more to me.
You can find value.
You can find value and neat, charm, and they're balanced great, and the quality's as good as any of them. I mean, you wouldn't know the difference in this gun between this and a Purdy sitting there. And so that's a neat thing that you got the accessibility to do. So I wanted to explain that.
Yeah, and that segues perfectly into the next question we're kind of talking about, so I'm just going to throw it in here. Should I get an old gun or a new gun? Which is better? And I think we're essentially covering those things. It's when you go into the vintage market, you can find incredible value. You can buy a gun that would cost today an exorbitant amount of money for a price that you might consider affordable or comparable to some other new gun. It's just the search is, I think, you have to know that you're going to be on the hunt a bit to find that value and to find the gun that works for you. Weight, size, characteristics, stock dimensions, all that stuff. You got to search for it.
Yeah, and it depends on what you think is better, okay? If you're like, I just want something reliable, all that stuff doesn't matter to me right now. I just need a gun that, fits me and can fit my budget. You can find a newer gun that's like we've talked about, we named many things that'll be reliable. You're going to go have fun with it and you're going to do fine, okay? But if better to you is incredible craftsmanship and it's going to bother you if it doesn't have perfect wood to metal fit, if it's going to bother you that it doesn't have these crisp, just crazy, incredible trigger pulls and the gun's not regulated to a super high level, vintage old world craftsmanship that's been done by hand is hands down precise and the best, okay, as far as detail and precision. But if quality you is just something that's going to be tough and get the job done and not let you down, you can still get something newer. Is that kind of explaining it right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've kind of gone down that road myself. I know I own vintage guns, and now I'm fortunate to hunt with some new guns that I really enjoy, and I see the value in both of them. And when you're talking about, I've got a French gun, or it's a French name gun. It's kind of a mystery. There's a little bit of history to it. I've talked to some folks about the gun. It was proofed in London. So where it was actually made is a bit of a mystery. It could be Belgian, but anyways, the name on the gun is French. I mean, I look at that gun. It's a 12 gauge, 6 pound, 10 ounce, 12 gauge. Beautiful balance. A lot of the stuff you were talking about, it's fully covered in rose and scroll bouquet and gray. I mean, just absolutely beautiful. And I got it for a price that you would pay for one of these newer guns that we're talking to you about that. But if I was buying that new today, I mean, there's no way I could afford that gun. It was made in a different time and place in history.
Yeah, exactly. And I, as I've gotten older, I value older things. And I picture those little craftsmen working on this gun forever and all the blood and sweat they put into it. And I like my guns to have a soul. When they've been around for 100 years and they're still ticking,
It's kind of cool.
it's kind of cool. And the gun, when I look at some where I can see that the weeds might have brushed against the stock, and I know this thing's hunted, over a couple different countries and tons of birds, the gun has a soul and it talks to me, and I like to continue that life in it. And but that's me as I've gotten older. I didn't have that same opinion when I was younger. And so some of these people will change down the road as they mature in the sport, and then they can buy another gun. I mean, buying another gun's always a great option.
A wise old grouse hunter told me the number of guns you need is always the number of guns you have plus one more. It's the N plus one rule.
I like that. I like that. That's been the story of my life. Before I did this podcast, I was thinking about it. And I was thinking, I've been buying and selling and trading guns for about 35 years, and I go through probably easily 5 to 10 guns a year.
It's a hobby in
And
itself for you, Doug.
I started to add that up, and that's hundreds, getting close to 1,000 that I've owned because I wanted to own them all
That's crazy.
and feel them and see the difference and pattern them, and just an obsession that I'm just like, holy cow, man, I could have bought a mansion or something. But then I couldn't hunt with it, right?
Right, that's right. Yep. Couldn't carry it to a beautiful place.
Yeah, no.
All right. Where do I get a good vintage side by side? There's some stuff in your book about this, and we talked about it before, but let's talk about it again here.
Yeah, I mean, I listed some in my book, and I knew, like I said, vintage doubles.
And that's Kirby Hoyt. You mentioned Kirby's name. That's Kirby Hoyt of Vintage Doubles. He's got a website. Most, if not all of his listings are on Guns International. And I think I said this when we had you on the last time, but I turn to Vintage Doubles a lot just to look at stuff because he's got such a good inventory of these guns that are pretty specific to, you know, he's buying them with the Upland Bird Hunter in mind, or at least it seems that way to me. I know you've talked to Kirby a lot. His listings, I think, are a really good place to just go and sort of get a feel for the marketplace and see what you can get for certain prices. I think he's got a lot of great stuff.
And what I would recommend to people, if you truly want a vintage gun, is I go to these guys that import them in from the UK. And that way, not only are they vintage, if you're buying an English gun, you've had English gunsmiths working on it, and they're putting the proper finish on them. They're blacking the barrels the way they're supposed to be. I don't buy ones in America that have been passed around and restored and done in America. So that's my recommendation there on that type of gun.
I think we did talk about this too, but Guns International, that's a website where you can go look at lots of guns. Is that one of the main ones that you, I mean, there's Gun Broker, I guess. I haven't spent as much time on those places lately, but
I haven't either. I usually go to their individual website, or I'm actually, most of these guys just email me their guns before they hit the market. But anyway, if you go to Guns International, you can look under Vintage Doubles. And that's what I'm going to deal with it, because they don't require an FFL because they're pre-1899. Mm. Or you can go to English Doubles right above it, and you're going to see a ton of guns listed. And, of course, you can go to Belgium Doubles, and you know, like you said, or you can go to Scottish Doubles.
Right. Those are the different categories you can browse on Guns International. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah. And that's all really neat stuff. And you just need to go to somebody reputable, like we said before. Make sure they're nitro-proof. Make sure they got plenty of wall thickness and they're safe and everything. And let these guys do that work for you.
Have you ever had a Francot, Doug, a Belgian gun?
Yes, I have, and I just sold my last one to a friend of mine, and they're very excellent, balanced bird guns. They're probably one of the best values, in a way, in a side-by-side coming from another country.
Yeah. Okay? They're not English, so the value proposition is higher, right?
Yes, and back in the day, and I know there's tons of incredible Belgian makers, of course, but back in the day, Francot was one of the top dogs.
Yeah.
They made some Damascus to die for, and they made lightweight bird guns, and that's why when you usually look at them, you find a lot of them with 26-inch barrels. They weigh around 6 pounds. The craftsmanship and the balance of them is excellent, and I even put that in a gun review. On my website on Francot when I first started it.
Very cool.
So that's a great question that you said, and a very good idea.
The reason I asked that is because I've got a buddy who's got, he might have a couple, either one or two, and I took his, borrowed his Francot 12, took it on a pheasant hunt at one point, and I really like those guns. They have a few different models and stuff over the years, but just the styling and aesthetics of the guns I really liked. And so I was kind of on the hunt for a Francot. That's what I was looking for when I eventually found that French gun, which is a Guillot, by the way. It's an Guillot. I found that, and it's very Francot-like, even so much so that it's sort of speculated a bit that it maybe could have been made by them, or they had something to do with it, but it's kind of like a Francot. So it kind of checked that box for me, which is why I asked.
Okay, and it probably is very well balanced little bird gun too.
Yeah, it's an awesome bird gun. I actually had to have Del Whitman bend the stock a little bit for me, but he did it, and now it fits me well. I shoot it well, and it's one that I feel lucky to own. It's just a, you know, 100-plus-year-old gun, and it's a beauty.
Wow. Yeah, that's the stuff you'll cherish and make some memories with for sure forever.
Yeah. All right. What sizes of shot do I use on different birds?
Yeah, I get that a lot because guys are just getting new into this, you know, and they're excited about it. So in my second book, I had a chart for every upland bird you can think of. And I went as far as to say what gauge is appropriate for hunting them, the chokes, and the size of shot. And I even have another chart a page or two away with maximum killing range for your chokes in relation to the ounces of shot. So that is super handy to people. And I just threw that out there because I can't sit and, you know, list everything as we're talking, because it varies so much compared to if you're hunting bobwhite quail to where if you're out there shooting sharptails, if you're into, you know, woodcock and grouse, or if you're shooting some wild, you know, Kansas pheasants and the wind's howling and it's cold outside, it's a totally different, you know, size of shot and choke. So that's why I made those graphs and listed it, because like me, that's one of my excuses for hoarding so much ammunition is I hunt them all. Okay.
Yeah.
I hunt them all.
All right. And that is, you know, I appreciate that. The chart in your book is one thing that we referenced before. And that question is, it sets up perfectly for looking at a chart to kind of just sort of analyze and give you a lot of information visually in a hurry. Is that in book number two, you said?
That's in book number two, yep. Okay.
Are both your books in stock right now? I had heard from some folks that one of them wasn't, but I don't know if that's correct.
Okay, they are now.
Okay.
I've got some at the house still. I got a whole other shipment that should be here next week at my house.
Okay.
But it was crazy because I think their factory was behind and so many people were buying them. Amazon even ran out for a while. Nobody could believe it. But now we're getting all stocked back up again. And
good.
It shouldn't be an issue. And I communicate great with people when they email me personally and how long it'll be and whatever, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so to just sort of tie a bow on that question, knowing that there are lots of variables, we can't get into everything. I'm just going to say a species of upland bird, and you just tell me a shot size that comes to mind that you have used or would use, you know, kind of the first shot size that comes to mind, all right?
Okay.
Woodcock.
8.
Ruffed grouse.
7.5.
Bobwhite quail.
8.
Pheasant.
Number 5s.
Chucker.
6 and 7.
Sharptails.
6.
Huns.
7.
That's all I got.
Okay. Thank God you need to start picking my brain saying, hey, I want to know about, you know, California quail. And I want to know. Yeah, this could have gone on forever.
Yeah, I went with the low hanging fruit, the most common ones I could think of, and again, just to throw a number out there for a reference point for folks, I think that will make sense for people.
And there's some crossover stuff, like, you know, when you're in a woodcock and grouse hunts. Hunting.
Yep.
Yeah, you're going to throw the logical shell that's good for both, right?
Yep.
And of course, I'm a left barrel guy, so I know this is really fanatic, but I always have a larger shot usually in my left barrel.
Yep.
Just another beauty of side by sides, right?
Again, and so let's, you know, sometimes I have a tendency to sort of breeze over this stuff, but just assume maybe somebody's wondering why the heck would you do that? But it's sort of the similar premise of the choke selection, where you have a more open choke in your first barrel and a tighter choke in your second barrel, just with the basic theory that if birds get up, your first shot is going to be closer than your second shot, and that tighter choke and larger shot size would be beneficial at a bird that's further away, correct?
Correct, exactly. Yeah.
All right, where do I hunt different birds? So that's a gigantic question, and we could do an episode on each species, and I'll throw in a plug for Onyx Hunt there being a very valuable tool to help you in finding birds. But when somebody asks you that, what are some things that come to mind, or how do you sort of tee off that conversation?
Well, I kind of tee it off by saying, you know, do your research, and some years is better some places than others. But, you know, if you're wanting pheasants, usually people brag about South Dakota. Some will find a neat place in North Dakota. They'll literally go to Kansas or Nebraska. They usually end up going to one of them that's closest to where they live and where they're saying that the rainfall was good and the numbers are up. Especially me, I have to do that because I hunt almost all public land. So I got to go where the birds are. But if you're hunting at a really nice lodge, that's supplementing the birds, it's not as much of an issue. And which a lot of people can afford to do that, and they want to do that. They want to go and hunt in a field. They want to see 500, 600 pheasants, and that's okay. Me, I go hunt the public land, and I got to beat the brush a little harder just to get a limit. And I enjoy that. It's a little more of a challenge, and I've killed so many birds, I'm okay with it. I don't need to kill a bunch of birds. And so I like the adventure of actually trying to seek them out on public land and adventuring all over the place without other people bothering me. And I like to feel that I'm just free and roaming around out there, you know.
Pulling the trigger is kind of the end of the line or the closing the loop, but there's a whole lot that leads up to that moment.
There really is. And you do have a, at my age, a certain amount of remorse. And I take pictures with them and take them home. And my wife makes a gourmet dinner with them. So we do everything respectfully and honorably, kind of the old school way. And our dogs, it's a great place to walk your dogs. They're free. And they're home out there. They're just in heaven, you know.
All right. I've been waiting to get to this question, Doug.
Oh boy.
What do you think of Nick Larson?
Oh, I love it. I got that one and I just about died laughing. I was like, you know, he's kind of a d. No, I was gonna say, man, this is a great question, but I think it's funny I got it because it is important that you're such a resource for these upland bird hunters, that you have been such a value to the upland bird hunter. It's been amazing. That's why you're taking this time right now to do this podcast with me. You have a passion for it and your passion's felt. People love it. That's why you're trying to help people out to get a good gun. And you've contacted me and I love your passion for side by sides and all the birds. And you're trying to learn as much as you can and you're wanting to share it with everybody. And so I know you're a young guy and just your knowledge and stuff is pretty incredible for your age. And what you're bringing to, you know, the United States, the people you're touching, because I got people buy books from the entire United States,
That's cool.
partially because they're all listening to your podcast. And it's gotten big. So you're doing something right, but people know that you're genuine. They know that you have a passion. They know that you care and that you love family. You love dogs. And you just have a spirit about you that's, I mean, I wouldn't be doing this podcast if I didn't think you were a great guy. But I do. And I got a strong belief in God, a strong belief in country and family. And the United States really needs it right now. They need all these positive things about, you know, family and getting out there in nature. And this is what this whole big story is all about. And you project that, and the friends you've made along the way is incredible. And I think you should be enjoying the journey. It ain't gonna last forever. And you get to share it with your son. You're paving a great path for your son, which I respect. And like I said, I'm big on those things, and I happen to be great friends with you, so that is saying a lot.
Well, I really appreciate that, Doug. That's a lot of kind words, but I certainly appreciate you pointing out that I am driven to learn, and the podcast would not be what it is without the guests on the show, you being one of them, and there's a whole host of other guests that have made this show what it is. And the fact that people do listen and find value in the conversation and learn things from the guests and me every once in a while is it's very gratifying and fulfilling. So I won't take all the credit. It's a lot of it goes back to the guests and the conversations that we have on the show, but I'm certainly thankful for you saying that. And I don't, maybe the people asking that were hoping for some juicy behind the scenes, sort of off the air stories. But I think I'm pretty much the same person before and after we hit the record button, Doug.
Exactly. What they hear is the truth, and what they see is what they get. And I like that. And so I couldn't say anything bad. I had to laugh, but people want to know
Sure.
because sometimes people behind the cover are a little bit different.
Absolutely. Yep.
But then when they contact me too, they learn, I really care about them. I try to answer their questions. Like I said, I do a little bit of selling vintage guns and try to help some people out.
Sure.
And this is about the big upland family, really, and it's growing. This is fun, and people are learning more than they think. They're not learning just about guns and just about a hunt. They're learning to love nature with their best friend, maybe their son, maybe their dad, maybe get back to some old traditions and some things that go with it.
Yeah.
And it's just the whole thing just warms your heart, really,
Yeah. No, that's well said, and I certainly hope that is part of it for a lot of people. It is for me, and a lot of times you don't necessarily realize it at the time. You can sort of draw on that as you reflect and look back, but it's all sort of interwoven, and that's what makes it what it is. It's very cool. It's well said, Doug.
And we like people. We care about people. We want people to be happy and enjoy some hobbies that we have found to be very fruitful. And that's why people just want to absorb it and learn so much about every aspect of it, And
Yeah.
you have delved into that aspect really good with all the different guests you've had and hit on bird dogs and
Yeah.
hunting these specific different grouse and where and how. And it's just been a quite an adventure, really.
Yeah. I would definitely adventure is a good way to describe it. I had a lot to learn, and still do, and that's really it's a key component to what makes the Birdshot Podcast what it is, and I appreciate when folks learn right along with me and the guests, so that's very cool. All right, so this next question, if it isn't apparent yet for folks throughout this entire conversation, why are side-by-sides so mesmerizing and addictive to Doug and myself and many, many other people?
Oh, wow.
You could just say like all of the above.
You really could. It's like if you've been listening, but no. I guess for different people, it's different things.
Yeah.
Some people, it's the actual balance and feel. Some people, it's that they're iconic and they're traditional. Some people, it's just the beautiful, the slim lines and the way they're developed or designed. For me, it's everything. And that's why I'm even getting into the older traditional guns, because I think it came from a time when there was more ethics and there was more standards and people cared about their work and craftsmanship. And that's what I kind of love about them.
Yeah.
And then coincidentally, I took them out and I've just proven for years this is the handiest tool. So there you go in a nutshell, really coming from my heart, about them.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of that. It's a lot of different things, and I think you've hit on it a couple times. It sort of evolves and changes as you handle and shoot more of them. But I do think one thing that comes up pretty common when folks are maybe waxing poetic about side by sides, but people do talk about sort of the lines and the aesthetics and the way it sets up. And I do think I guess fallen for that, if you will. It's very pleasing the way that the side-by-side shotgun is set up and handles and feels, and then when you take it out into the field and have success with it, and I pretty much only shoot side-by-sides now, so I'm kind of maybe you get the blinders on a bit, but I don't find myself having a much of a desire to stray from that because they do what I need it to do, and I really like the way that they do the job.
I do too. And upland hunting is sacred to me, and hunting and the art of hunting. And I think a side by side takes you to the highest level of my passion in the uplands, the tool. And I think that's one reason why it was king, in the UK, because they're snobs and they try to take things to the highest level and the highest dollar amount and everything. And so, me, it's kind of that way that I've just evolved to it. And people will do that with certain bird dogs and
Right.
all kinds of
Yeah,
stuff,
it's not an uncommon way of progression, I guess.
It's not, I'm not totally crazy.
Yes, yeah, we're not crazy.
People might think so, and but then they could be right, but I'm happy in my own craziness.
Yes. That's important.
mean, my bird dogs don't think I'm crazy. They think I'm the neatest thing around.
That is important as well.
You know?
Well, there were a couple other ones, but I think that's we've got a good time of conversation here, and that was a I think that was a good one to sort of wrap this one up on, and we'll of course sort of leave the tease that this very likely won't be the last time we have Doug on, so feel free to keep as long as Doug's okay with it, keep asking him questions, and we'll keep collecting them until next time.
And I'll tell you, everybody's got to get my books. The first one's The Foundation. The second one's way more advanced, okay? And they got to, because here pretty soon, if people are talking about it, they request a part three. We got to hear what needs to be covered in part three.
There
what
you
do
go.
People demand? What do they want?
Yep.
And I listen. I mean, that's how I came up with two. Or do they just want it to die after part two? You know, so we need feedback, and people got to hurry up and get these two if they want to move on, you know.
Absolutely. Where's the best place for people to go? You got a website, I know that.
Well, when they go to my website, I realize it costs about $5 more, and I'm a little slower getting to the post office, so they might get their book a few days later, but I personally sign it, and sometimes I sneak a little special card in there, and if they're wanting to talk to me about some guns and stuff, they can email me, and we get a little thing going. Otherwise, they can go to Amazon and get it a couple days quicker, probably about $5 cheaper without having to pay the shipping. And last I heard, I think they were out of them at Gunnerman Books.
Okay.
So right now, I think it's my website and Amazon, as far as I know.
Okay. And I will definitely put a link. What's the website? I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I have done it before, obviously. I know I can grab it, but just say it here on the podcast.
So it's DougStewartAuthor.com.
Okay.
And of course, if Nick ever wants to carry them, he can carry them. And, we're going to do some other great things in the future. We're going to, maybe get a little bit into the vintage guns, maybe get into the vintage ammo.
Yeah.
Whatever we can supply the upland bird hunters with to help them, And I'm sure you're wanting to grow and do different things. It's just you can only do so much so quick.
Absolutely. If folks want to get in touch with you, is there a contact page on the website? How do they reach out to you, Doug?
There is. When they go to that website, it has a little thing you can click on the bottom. That's my my Gmail, and because that's what they order the book through, the PayPal.
Yeah. Okay.
And please put the note in there if you want book one or book two.
Okay.
Because they can write me a little note with the PayPal purchase, and then they can ask me questions. And I'm a little slow getting back to them because I got a lot of questions. I get confused sometimes, and I'm working a lot.
But
so it might take
you'll
me a
get
week.
To it.
Yeah, I haven't forgotten you. I mean, I could have, but it's probably going to take me a week to get back to you, and I apologize. And if it's a real long thing, I usually ask for their phone number. I'm like, just please give me your phone number, because it doesn't do me any good if I take a week to email them back. And then they always have a response, and they email me again, and we go back and forth.
Yeah.
Instead, if it's something pretty complex, I'd rather just call them, have a nice little conversation. I get to meet some neat gentlemen, and there you go.
Yeah. Yep. I know that all too well. I get contacted plenty through the podcast, and a lot of times if it's a longer email, sometimes I'll set it aside because I don't want to just fire off a quick response. I want to do something more thoughtful, and then some time goes by, and that's so yeah. Jumping on the phone is easier when that happens. So I definitely know that struggle very well.
Yep, I think that's great. I think we had some neat things that needed covered. About getting to the roots of these, upland side by sides, and what it really takes to eat one tonight.
Yeah, and like you said, the feedback and questions and comments and stuff, that's a big component of how I continue to shape and decide what episodes to do here on the podcast. So same goes for me as it goes for Doug. We always value that feedback and those questions, and it will shape future episodes, and in Doug's case, hopefully a book number three. I got my fingers crossed, Doug. I want part three.
All right. Well, let's see what people want in it.
All right, buddy. Well, hey, this was a blast as always. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast. I know we have a lot of fun doing it, but I do appreciate you making yourself available. It's always fun. And I'll look forward to the next time we have you on the show. Hang on with me for just a second, buddy. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks, Doug.
God bless you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.